Women's Health Melbourne is an innovative, holistic fertility and women's health practice. We are world leaders in IVF and egg freezing and provide our patients with every opportunity to achieve their goals.
Our hand-picked, expert team provides the ultimate care experience for our patients. Reach us at womenshealthmelbourne.com.au and follow us at Women's Health Melbourne and at Dr. Raylia Liu. Hello, and welcome back to Knocked Up, the podcast about fertility and women's health. You are joined, as always, by me, Geordie Morrison, and Dr. Raylia Liu, CREI Fertility Specialist. Welcome back, Raylia.
It's great to be here.
Today's episode, Raylia, you have titled IVF, Science and Emotions.
I wanted to talk about this topic today as I reflect back on my week. I've had a wonderful week in many ways, and there's also been quite a lot of sadness. And that's a day in the life in fertility medicine. You'll see patients who get pregnant after a significant uphill battle. You'll see patients who send photos of their baby. I had a beautiful photo of a baby sent to me born this week who was the result of a really hard IVF journey for her parents. And it was such a shared victory to see her beautiful smiling face. My patient's smiling face. Babies can't smile quite yet when they're very, very tiny. I look forward to the 1 year update for the baby smile. I also had a patient who had a really difficult pregnancy loss this week. I've had patients who are pregnant with a history of recurrent pregnancy loss who are very, very anxious, as is 100% expected, that I've supported during this week. It's really normal in IVF to have a roller coaster of emotions. And I thought it might be good to talk about it and to potentially explore some of the important pieces of knowledge that can help have a context for what to expect in IVF so that we can arm ourselves with that. I think it's a big assistance to our resilience, and that in itself is an important ingredient to the pursuit of ultimate success, because it can take a while and it can be difficult, and having the energy and momentum and ability to have optimism in the face of sadness is what people sometimes need to help them ultimately succeed.
So what we're saying is assisted reproductive treatment is a summary heading used to describe all aspects of medically assisted conception. So egg freezing and IVF. ART, pun intended, is a mixture of art and science. So you've got technical skill, intelligent strategic planning, coordination of a multidisciplinary team of amazing players. So scientists, fertility specialists, nurses, reception team, everyone. And infertility has a lot of ups and downs, and it requires good communication and empathy. An understanding of science and biology is imperative to contextualize the events in your fertility treatment, and that's what we're going to cover today. First question, how many treatments is normal? And maybe do we need to define treatments?
I think it's really important to always say that care is individual, and so are the circumstances that people bring when they come for help. Some problems are easier to get around than others. Some are multi-layered. There's a lot of complexity when you bring a couple together to help them have a baby, and factors like age, anatomical concerns, different pathologies that might be present both on the male side and also on the female side in a heterosexual context, things like fibroids, adenomyosis, endometriosis. These kind of conditions are very common in the patients that I treat. When we're talking about fertility treatments, there are all kinds of treatments that we sometimes use. Sometimes we're using ovulation induction therapy to restore a regular rhythm and a release of an egg for someone with a problem like polycystic ovarian syndrome. Sometimes we're trying to help sperm that needs a little bit of help in ways to get pregnant, like IUI or intrauterine insemination. That's often also something we think about with donor sperm, to help a woman get pregnant in the context of being single or where the male partner has insufficient sperm or no sperm suitable to attempt a pregnancy, in a same-sex relationship. So lots of different contexts for the use of donor sperm. We also do a lot of IVF in our practice, and that is a really good therapy in many circumstances and a very imperfect therapy in others. There's not a lot that IVF achieves in terms of embryo quality when we're talking about treating infertility associated with advancing age, because a lot of mistakes are made in embryos as we get older, and it becomes harder and harder to find a normal embryo. So to go back to your original question, which I'm not trying to subvert, the number of treatments that is quote unquote normal is different for different people. If you look at population averages, so if you look back at the ANZAR data, and that's every cycle, for example, of IVF in a calendar year in every unit that practices IVF in Australia and New Zealand, the average age of a patient being treated is about 38 years of age from a female perspective. And the average number of cycles, and when I say cycles, I mean full IVF treatments, including egg collection, creation of embryos, transfer subsequently of every embryo created to make a baby, is well over 3 cycles. So complete stimulated cycles with egg collection. But of course, for every average, we have to understand that some people have a life experience that is better than average, and others have a life experience that is significantly worse than average. And all of those individualized factors help us know who is going to land in which category to some degree. There's also the magic ingredient of good luck. You have to be a little bit lucky to get pregnant. That's in nature and with assisted reproductive medicine. And the reason I say that is, even when everything is perfect, implantation has no barriers, all the stars align, the embryo has a massive role to play, and it has to developmentally achieve milestones that are very complex, each of which cannot be achieved if the former milestone that came just before has not been achieved correctly. There is a big chance element to that. You can have all the right instructions as an embryo and make a mistake in their implementation in the complex events of making a baby human. What I would say to people contemplating fertility treatments is, you can't think of it, or you shouldn't think of it, like other medical treatments, like an operation, for example, to fix a broken bone or something like that. Those kind of treatments have a goal that can be achieved probably 99% of the time, from the outset of the operation to the end of the operation. And there's also a date that it's going to happen. There may be some other factors around healing, etc., that might be variable, but it's a very predictable course. With IVF, your doctor and yourself, you know, you can implement everything as instructed exactly correctly and not get pregnant. Or you can get pregnant and lose a baby. You can have a biochemical pregnancy. You can have an ectopic pregnancy. Every single thing that can go wrong in a normal pregnancy, unfortunately, can still go wrong in an IVF pregnancy. So I encourage my patients to not have a sober perspective, but have a realistic perspective of what is entailed in IVF, what is likely to happen. And it doesn't necessarily make it easier if something negative happens to you. The fact that you know about it, however, means it can't hit you out of left field. It can't make you feel like, wow, I never even knew that was a possibility. I think that helps people to cope when less than perfect events occur. And I think having a sound knowledge of the biology, it helps people pull themselves up by their bootstraps if things don't go perfectly the first time, because they understand that that's not the way nature works.
This might oversimplify things, but how long do most people spend doing IVF?
I think that's actually a really good question. I would say probably 6 to 12 months is a realistic answer. From the time that you decide to first do IVF, for example, it might be a couple of months before you get ready to start treatment. There's a lot of actually getting ready that we need to do. That includes a lot of investigations to make sure that, firstly, we're not missing anything. Secondly, we're optimizing everything that can be modifiable to try and improve your chances of success. Thirdly, there's a lot of complexity to IVF, and so there's quite a comprehensive consent process to go through. There's a counseling appointment to go through. There's a detailed treatment plan, at least for your initial treatment, to be made with your specialist. And then IVF treatments, unlike operations, happen over a 2-week period. So there's an education piece to teach you what to do in that time and to support you. So there's a lot of getting ready before we even start. And then, you know, every time we put an embryo back, depending on your age, the chance of you becoming pregnant is going to be, on average, if you're the average IVF patient, 1 in 3 to 1 in 4. So it can take a few goes over several months. And in terms of getting your uterus ready for an embryo transfer, it takes pretty much a month, because it takes about 2 weeks to grow a nice lining. And there's different ways we can do that. We then have to prepare the lining for the embryo transfer to ensure that you have receptivity achieved with the right amount of progesterone exposure, whether that's from a natural ovulation or whether it's from some support from medications. And then once we place the embryo back inside the womb, we need to wait to see if you're pregnant. And that's the famed 2-week wait that we have talked about many times on this podcast. But that's when we unfortunately have to distract ourselves and be hopeful and also guard our emotions because the outcome is uncertain. So it can take many months before we're ultimately successful. And I would say that is the average patient experience. It is quite normal that it can take not only several cycles, but also several embryo transfers to achieve an ongoing pregnancy for a lot of patients.
And what does that mean in terms of how many embryos make a baby? We talk a lot about how many eggs you need, how many embryos you need to have in storage. So how many do you need?
So this is a really interesting question as well, and something I talk about a lot with my patients, particularly my patients who come to me in their mid-30s and beyond, who ideally would love to have more than one child and have struggled to have their first. Embryo banking is a really strong strategy in this context. I always say, when you first see me for IVF, you are the best prognosis IVF patient that you will ever be from this time point forward in your life. You're the youngest you're ever going to be. You've got the best egg quality you're ever going to have, and you've got the most robust ovarian reserve or egg number that you're ever going to have. So it is an opportunity, and those who know me well will know that I'm a massive fan of freezing embryos for family planning, because it helps me, firstly, have a better chance of achieving for my patients their goals for themselves over time. But it also means that when we do the stimulated cycle part of IVF, we hope to set ourselves up not to have to come back to that in future years. And we hope to, with our efforts of today, make tomorrow's treatment less of a burden on a family. And that's really important, particularly in that coming back to have subsequent children, you already have a child, and it is a little bit more tricky to attend complex treatments that require anesthetics. So having some frozen embryos and simplifying baby number two is really powerful. In terms of how many embryos make a baby, at the end of the day, every baby comes from one, but the average experience is it takes 3 or 4 goes. So I usually say a safe number of embryos, and you can never say 100%. No number of embryos that we freeze will give us 100% certainty. But I usually say 3 to 4 embryos per child desired in the future is a good place to start.
What are possible outcomes?
So possible outcomes of IVF treatments, what we're aiming for, what our goal is to help you have a baby. And in an ideal world, when we're planning long term, to help you have the number of babies that you ultimately want in your family. And I would say, as a caveat, that the vast majority of my patients achieve that goal. The vast majority. It's not always easy. It's not always fast. But the vast majority of my patients who I have counseled from the beginning that they have a good chance of becoming pregnant do get pregnant. Having said that, there will be some people who try and try and try and are not destined to succeed. It is a minority. but it's a real minority, and it's incredibly upsetting and sad for patients in that circumstance, and I certainly don't want to downplay it in the slightest. But even in patients who are ultimately successful, there can be roadblocks. You can have an embryo transfer and have a biochemical pregnancy, which is frustrating. The embryo has taken, it has implanted. We did everything right, and then the pregnancy doesn't proceed. And that happens commonly both for couples without infertility and in IVF. We know that from studies of really sensitive HCG or pregnancy tests that actually in couples who are not infertile, one in two cycles results in a biochemical pregnancy. So sperm and egg got together, an embryo formed, an implantation was attempted, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out in 50% of the cases. That is a really common outcome. And of course, there are other cycles where you don't get pregnant at all and you don't have a positive pregnancy test, and we never know where that fizzled. We don't know if the egg and sperm got together and made an embryo and the embryo didn't progress, or we don't know if very early implantation happened but it just wasn't strong enough to register a test. So it's different for different people. So yeah, you can have a negative pregnancy test, you can have a biochemical pregnancy, you can have a miscarriage, which is when we have a, and then you can argue biochemical pregnancy is a miscarriage, just a very early one. You can have a miscarriage that's a clinical miscarriage where we see ultrasound evidence of a pregnancy, but unfortunately it doesn't proceed. And that can happen either at the very early stage. It's very common up to the 6-week mark. And usually when it happens before then, it's because of a chromosome error or a developmental error. It can sometimes, unfortunately, happen after the 6-week mark as well. It can even happen later on in a pregnancy into the second and third trimester, unfortunately, and after 20 weeks gestation, a pregnancy loss is termed a stillbirth rather than a miscarriage. You can have an ectopic pregnancy. So that's when we place an embryo in the womb in IVF and it goes into a fallopian tube. That's often a sign that the lining of the uterus might not have been so receptive and a good embryo was looking for somewhere to stick. We can also have a situation where you can have a different type of ectopic pregnancy, like a cesarean scar ectopic or a cervical ectopic. Those kind of pregnancies are rarer, but that's where an embryo is implanted somewhere inappropriate, and unfortunately that's a devastating outcome because those types of pregnancies are not going to be ongoing. You can have a molar pregnancy, which can also happen in IVF, although it's not so common. So look, there's lots of different ways that pregnancies unfortunately can go wrong, and what I always say is IVF doesn't protect you against those completely. It can protect you a little bit if you do genetic testing of embryos, because one of the causes of miscarriage that's very, very common, affecting half of all miscarriages, is chromosome error that's random. And random error happens more and more commonly over the age of 35. It can happen at any age, but it's very common over 35. And at that age, about one in two embryos has this problem. The embryo makes a random error. So we can reduce the risk of recurrent miscarriage for patients undertaking IVF by limiting the embryos we transfer to embryos that have proven to have the right DNA makeup. And that will reduce the miscarriage rate by 50%, but it won't eliminate the miscarriage rate because a lot of pregnancy losses are caused by just developmental problems rather than genetic ones. So look, those are all possible outcomes of any pregnancy and also of assisted reproduction.
In a way, you've touched on this, but why is individualising the treatment strategy so important?
We are all individuals and our goals are different from the goals of others, and our bodies are different from the bodies of others. We need to take into account when we're planning IVF, what do we want? What are we trying to achieve here? And it's not a cookie cutter answer, so it can't be a cookie cutter treatment. Some people want to get pregnant ASAP and this is going to be their last baby and they don't need anything in the freezer for later. You know, maybe they've come to IVF because a partner's had a vasectomy and they just want one more baby together and there's not a particular problem with the female partner. You know, so that's one scenario, but you can have other scenarios. A patient might come to IVF after having had 3 or 4 miscarriages due to chromosome error at an older age, and they may definitely want genetic testing of embryos to reduce the risk of that happening again. You might have a patient who really wants a larger family but didn't meet the person they wanted to have a family with until later in life, and the really only way that they might have a chance of achieving that is banking embryos now for the future, and that's the right move for them. You might have a patient who needs to have treatment in a certain way because of medical factors or because of their job or their life that we need to work around. For example, they might want to make embryos now because they've been struggling for a long time to conceive, but they might have just got a new job and they wouldn't get maternity leave unless we defer transfer of their embryo for a certain period of time. So look, it's all about treating the patient in front of you for the concerns that they have, both individually and as a couple, and kind of playing to win, if you like, playing to meet their needs and achieve their goals.
One thing you can really help with if a couple comes to you early enough is long-term family planning. What's involved there?
So that just really means thinking about how many babies somebody wants and then talking to them about, well, what's the timeline? How are we going to achieve this? And tailoring our strategy to that. And an example might be some couples might choose to take a first step of IUI because they want to have a less invasive fertility treatment. But if you have a chat to them about potentially that they might like to have a strategy that's more geared to longer term planning of multiple children, well, IUI doesn't give them that, so they might then consider IVF instead because they can bank embryos through IVF. So it's about really presenting the various options to patients and then engaging them in informed decision-making and shared decision-making so that you don't deprive them of opportunities by leading them down one treatment pathway and ensuring there's no decision or regret for the future and providing the opportunity to plan for as many babies as a couple ultimately desire.
So the numbers start off great and then they go down. Egg collection, what happens next? Because that's the first step.
So when people are doing egg freezing or IVF, they'll have an idea in their mind of what they would like to achieve. And then they'll learn a bit about their body as to what their body's capable of achieving in a particular month. And then they'll get a little bit of feedback from the ultrasound monitoring that happens in their cycle as to how many eggs they might expect to collect. It's really important to understand that when we see a follicle, an ovarian follicle on an ultrasound, we can't see an egg. Actually, an egg's microscopic. You can't see it with the human eye, let alone on a screen. But you certainly can't see an egg in a follicle on an ultrasound. So what you make an assumption, I think, as a patient that there is an egg inside every follicle, and that's not the case. So the egg is a single cell. Each little egg is a single cell. We made it when we were a baby, and sometimes they haven't made the distance of our lifetime. Sometimes they no longer exist within the follicle. Sometimes eggs within follicles don't get with the program, with what we're trying to influence them to do with medications and with hormones. So sometimes they will not be mature eggs. They might be germinal vesicles. They might be kind of what we call the M1 oocytes that haven't kind of done what they were meant to do at the time of the trigger by the time we collect them. And sometimes follicles will indeed be empty, the so-called empty follicle syndrome or oocyte atresia, which is when the egg dies. That happens more and more as we get older. So I would say to women going into egg collection, not every follicle gives us an egg. So if you go into an egg collection expecting that every follicle you see on scan will give you an egg, that's a glass more than half full approach. And it's highly unlikely to happen. So that opens the doorway for great disappointment when what is very predictable, that not every follicle will give you an egg, ultimately happens. So I think that's a really important learning point for most people, just to understand that if you get an egg from 60% of the follicle strain, that is good. The next kind of opportunity for disappointment, I guess, in egg freezing is not every egg is frozen, and that comes down to the fact that some eggs are not good eggs. But for IVF, not every egg will fertilize. When we fertilize eggs, we put egg and sperm together. It's not simply a matter of some fertilize and some don't, although some do fertilize and some don't. But even those that do fertilize sometimes don't fertilize in a normal way. So you can fertilize abnormally as well. So three kinds of things that can happen when you put sperm and egg together. Probably there's more than three. So for example, if you inject sperm into an egg using ICSI, one outcome is the egg disintegrates or lies, as we say, or bursts open. And so you do lose some eggs through degeneration. So that's a fourth a fourth thing that can happen. So your egg either fertilizes normally or it doesn't, and there's several varieties of when it doesn't. Either not at all, maybe there's three pronuclei, maybe there's one pronuclear, so abnormal fertilization, or egg degeneration, particularly after ICSI. So not every egg will normally fertilize. And then from that point, not every fertilized egg will go on to make an embryo that's suitable for transfer. And when we culture embryos to transfer them, we take about a week to decide whether an embryo is suitable. Over that course of time, the best embryos will get where they're going on day 5. Some will take till day 6 and they can still be very strong and very good. They just take a little bit longer. So they're not the fastest in the race, but they still get to the finish line. And then there'll be some that even take a bit longer to day 7. The longer it takes an embryo to do the right thing, the less likely it is to make a baby, as a rule of thumb. So a day 5 embryo will always trump a day 6 embryo, even if the grading is the same. And likewise, a day 6 will trump a day 7. But we obviously don't want to throw babies out with the bathwater, and we want to make sure that every embryo that has a chance to make a baby is preserved. In an IVF cycle, if we're doing an embryo transfer in a fresh cycle, and more, my personal belief is that frozen may be better for a lot of people, because the lining of the uterus is a bit overstimulated in a hormonally stimulated cycle. When we do transfer an embryo in a stimulated cycle, that has to happen on day 5, and that's the actual reason that the hormones that we inject make our lining a bit overcooked, and so beyond day 5 is not a receptive zone. So even though in nature embryos can implant after day 5, day 6 is just fine in nature where you haven't had all those drugs, but not in a stimulated cycle. So the fact that the embryo got there on day 6 can be a bit confusing to some people, because they think, oh, the embryo transfer happened on day 5, but this embryo only got there on day 6. Just think of it like in nature, it's like a bell curve. Some embryos get there faster, some take a bit longer. That's fine. The implantation window in a natural cycle is much more giving. It's much more forgiving. It's much more receptive. And that's part of the nuance and part of the philosophy over frozen embryo transfer, sometimes yielding a better pregnancy rate than fresh, because we're putting the embryo back in a better zone. But then, you know, once we get to the embryo phase, we know not every embryo makes a baby. And so there's this kind of downwards trajectory in your numbers, from how many follicles to how many eggs to how many fertilized to how many embryos, and then you get a chance to get pregnant. So that is a really natural and normal thing. It's normal for that to happen in IVF. It doesn't make it feel any better just because it's normal. And I think a lot of patients find it very disappointing, because a lot of us are very natural optimists, and we're kind of like, okay, I know the doctor told me not every follicle gives me an egg, but I want an egg from every follicle. And when it doesn't happen, it's disappointing.
If there's one thing I've learned doing this podcast for the last 5.5 years, it's that age is really, really important, possibly the most important factor with fertility. What about age?
So age is definitely something that catches up with all of us from a fertility perspective, particularly women, also men. There becomes an age for all of us, and it's going to be slightly different for each of us, where our eggs can't make babies anymore. And every single woman will reach that age, and the challenge is having our babies before we reach that age. After we reach an age where the eggs can't make babies anymore, we can still technically have babies, but we might need to use an egg from somebody else. Or if we were savvy enough to freeze a lot of eggs when we were younger, we can use our own eggs that we froze. I had a patient the other day who came to me who had quite a lot of frozen eggs and was in her early 40s, and said to me, I just want one baby. Should I just use my frozen eggs, or should I do other things? And my answer to her was, well, you know, why not use your frozen eggs? That's what they're there for. That's what we put them away for. They've got a better chance. Whereas if the same patient at the same age had come back to me and said, I'd really love to have 2 children, I want to keep my frozen eggs up my sleeve because I know when I come back for my second, it'll be game over with my eggs collected now, and I want to keep them in case I need them then I would have given her a different treatment plan advice. So again, just coming back to the fact that we need to look at the person, we need to look at their situation, we need to look at their goals, we need to look at their assets. And then we've got to make a plan that's 100% individualised.
And where does preconception genetic testing come into it, and how do we decide who it's appropriate for?
Genetic testing, I always say to patients, it doesn't change the embryo, it just gives us information. If you're someone who can't make many embryos, it might be actually against our better judgment to test your embryos, because it means that we expose them to risk. When you biopsy an embryo to test it and when you freeze it, you do expose it to risk, and it's a greater risk than just freezing the embryo. That is something that we have to bear in mind, because a biopsy of an embryo to get cells to the lab to test is like a little operation on the embryo, so it's not without risk. It can also come with a risk of misdiagnosis, or not necessarily misdiagnosis, but clouded diagnosis, because some embryos are mosaic, which means they've got some cells that are normal, some cells that are abnormal. The problem didn't come from the egg and sperm. It came from the cell divisions of the embryo itself. We're testing the outer layer that's going to be the placenta. We're not testing the inner cell mass of the embryo, which is ultimately going to be the child. You can get a normal baby from a mosaic embryo, and potentially knowing about it might raise a level of anxiety. So that in itself can be something that can cause worry and concern for patients. You certainly should consider genetic testing of embryos if you are worried about a risk of passing a disease on to a child, something that you carry yourself or your partner carries or you both carry in terms of a recessive condition. And you should also consider genetic testing of embryos if you're somebody who has just had miscarriage after miscarriage because of embryo problems, and we just don't want to go through that anymore. You know, we just want to reduce your risk as much as possible. Sometimes genetic testing is part of an IVF diagnostic strategy for people who are not getting pregnant with normal looking embryos, and we think it's probably the embryo's genome, but we just want to make sure that that's it. And when we do test embryos in that context and we find that someone's embryos are mostly abnormal, then, you know, we say, well, actually, we've done every test known to man to check that there's no receptivity problem, no autoimmune problem, and hey, it's the embryo, so let's just find a normal one and hopefully you'll be right. There are lots of reasons to genetically test embryos. I guess the downside of genetic testing of embryos is that it adds cost, and it means that you have a delay between when you do your stimulation and when you do your transfer, and that sometimes is the right thing for some people, and particularly when you are someone who is older, when you're someone who has lower egg numbers, so your hormones are not that high in IVF compared to people who make lots and lots and lots of eggs in one go, then genetic testing of embryos may not be right for you. And so I always say there's no generic advice that is correct. It's a nuanced discussion, and it's a discussion in the context of your individual circumstances with your doctor.
So we've talked about optimism, sadness, excitement, expectations.
Yep, all of those are part of IVF. It's a very emotional time to treat somebody. It's a very emotional area of medicine. I think as an IVF specialist and as a human, you know, we do kind of care a lot about what happens for our patients. We're very invested. I find I'm incredibly invested in my patient's success. And personally, it's obviously very important to be professional, but it's also something that I do definitely ride the highs and lows with my patients in IVF. And I think our whole team does, actually. You know, our nurses, our scientists, even our reception team, who need to find a time when there is no time to fit in a patient who needs an urgent review because they've had a negative result. You know, we all do try and accommodate and try to support our patients, our counselling team, who offer amazing support to our patients at different stages of the journey. And it's really something that, you know, we hold you through your lows and we celebrate your highs with you. And nothing makes me happier than when I get my little pings on my Instagram and I get the photos of the babies. I love that so much. And I always post the babies, even though to some degree, I mean, I think on social media, it's always a risk that you might trigger someone's negative emotions. But I think it's really important to celebrate the wins. And the wins are so amazing.
The wins are so amazing. The whole team here, we live by our results, and it's just so exciting when we get to meet the babies. For women freezing eggs, so this is a bit of future-proofing, the outcomes are uncertain when you are freezing your eggs.
Yeah, so all of the things we've talked about, not every follicle gives us an egg, not every egg makes an embryo, all these things happen in IVF made from frozen eggs, and embryos are made from frozen eggs. But when we freeze eggs, we don't see that attrition. We don't see that downwards stepwise kind of like unfolding of the IVF story. But I know when I tell somebody how many eggs to freeze, I know that not every egg is going to warm properly. I know not every egg is going to fertilize. And I know not every egg that does fertilize is going to make a transferable embryo. So when I do the maths and when I tell people to freeze a certain number of eggs based on their age, I do it by calculating a probability of success. And, you know, with egg freezing, my goal is that when you come back to use your frozen eggs, we have a baby. And so I will always tell you to freeze a high number of eggs because there is safety in numbers in IVF. And when we say, well, actually the average IVF baby's born as a result of three cycles of IVF, but hey, just do one cycle of egg freezing, you'll be right. Those mathematics don't actually equate. I always realistically counsel my patients when they're talking about egg freezing. And thus far in my career, I have been on the most part vindicated in the success rates of my patients returning to use their frozen eggs, which is like one of my favorite things about my job. I love it when people come back to use their frozen eggs. I'm doing a pregnancy ultrasound this week for one of my patients who I froze eggs for 6 years ago, who's now pregnant. I kind of made her move her scan because I wanted to do it myself, because I just want to close the chapter. It's just so fulfilling. I love it.
Thank you so much, Raelia, and lovely to get the insight into the day-to-day, really.
To support Knocked Up, leave us a review or recommend to a friend. Join us on Instagram at Knocked Up Podcast and join Raelia at Dr. Raelia Lu. And email us your questions to podcast@womenshealthmelbourne.com.au.